vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Susan, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 4th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first article I would like to read is written by William McGurm, and it is entitled, Congress Risks a Key Trump Victory. Deregulation may not be sexy, but it can be consequential for small businesses. Congress is putting major Trump victory at risk. The victory came in March 2025 when the Treasury announced it would spare U.S. citizens and U.S. companies with fewer than 20 employees and $5 million or less from a onerous regulation requiring they declare their beneficial owners. Not a sexy win. It didn't attract much attention outside the financial press, but sometimes those are the most consequential. According to the National Federation of Independent Business, the move last year exempted more than 32 million small businesses from what the White House estimates is more than $128 billion in regulatory and compliance costs. The NFIB's ire is directed at the Corporate Transparency Act. In 2020, Congress passed the CTA as part of the National Defense Authorization Act in the last days of the first Trump administration, then voted for it again to override President Trump's veto. The law defines a beneficial owner as anyone who directly or indirectly exercises substantial control of a business or who owns at least 25% of the company. Proponents said the CTA was meant to go after money launderers and drug dealers. The result is altogether different: a hefty compliance burden on small businesses that leave their confidential business data less secure. There are questions, too, about whether it is constitutional as a federal mandate reaching into state charters entities. Evidence that the CTA deters real criminals is thin. More to the point, if law enforcement really needs information from small business, it can always obtain a subpoena. The good news is that so long as Mr. Trump remains in office, the law is unlikely to be enforced. But NFIB President and CEO Brad Close worries that could change once Mr. Trump leaves office or if Democrats take Congress in the upcoming midterms. President Trump's decision to exempt American small businesses from the unconstitutional beneficial ownership information mandate eliminated more than $128 billion in regulatory costs, Mr. Close says. If Congress fails to fully repeal BOI or codify President Trump's action, small businesses remain concerned that a future administration could reimpose this costly mandate and its severe penalties. So, Republicans in Congress have been trying to repeal the whole thing instead of settling for the reversible half victory that leaves this law on the books. Given that Republicans hold the White House and both houses of Congress, taking this tax on small business off the table permanently should be a no-brainer. There are several different legislative options, but the main one that would fully repeal the CTA is H.R. 425, the Repealing Big Brother's Overreach Act. You might think an effort to relieve pressure on small businesses would have strong bipartisan support. Wrong. No Democrat has put his name on the bill, which doesn't augur well for full repeal. If the burden won't take effect until Trump leaves office, what's so urgent about repealing CTA now? The answer is that Congress has less than a month to go until summer recess. The current NDAA is arguably the only must-pass piece of legislation, which is why small business is desperate to attach a measure repealing the CTA to it. Both houses will adjourn for summer recess, the House on July 4th and the Senate on August 10th. In September, the focus in Washington will turn from legislation to midterms, and if Dems retake either chamber, any hope for small businesses goes down with the Republican ship. The House's failure to adopt an amendment to the NDAA that would lock in protections against CTA's regulatory overreach changes the game. The hope now is that Senate Majority Leader John Thune will use his influence to rally Republican troops to do what his counterpart in the House, Speaker Mike Johnson, hasn't. The wonder is that Republicans haven't already seized the issue to emphasize their credentials in standing up for small businesses. This is an opportunity to draw a line between the party that believes in the ingenuity of America's smallest entrepreneurs and the party that believes that drivers of wealth and opportunity are there to be taxed and regulated. Deregulation has been one of Mr. Trump's shining achievements. He ought to demand that Congress acts. Large corporate competitors and the Wall Street are exempt from this mandate. It only applies to Main Street small businesses, says Mr. Close. Small business owners aren't looking for a handout. They just want the government to get out of the way and let them grow, hire, and give back to their communities. Next, under review and outlook, parental consent in the smartphone age. The justices won't halt a Texas App Store law as Ohio wins on appeal. The dam seems to be breaking on legislative efforts to protect children on the internet. On Monday, the Supreme Court declined to block a Texas law requiring app stores to verify user ages with a system of parental consent for those under 18. No justice expressed dissent, and the Texas law might soon be enforced. Only 3 weeks ago, a federal appeals court upheld Ohio's law, saying that social media sites can't serve users under age 16 without first getting parental consent. A district court last year had said this was unconstitutional under the First Amendment. Yet, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed. The ruling is split, but the lead opinion applies strict judicial scrutiny, and it argues that Ohio's demand for parental consent passes the test. That requirement, Judge Eric Clay says, constitutes a marginal burden that precisely targets the multifaceted problem that Ohio has identified: children's unsupervised assent to terms and conditions for use of platforms that take advantage of and harm them. Judge Alice Batchelder said she's skeptical that strict scrutiny applies. But in any case, she says the internet group NetChoice did not satisfy its burden to officially challenge the act. She and Judge Clay also agree that NetChoice lacks standing to bring a lawsuit asserting the rights of internet users under age 16. The opinions, plus a dissent from Judge Kevin Ritz, run for 71 pages and include other points of legal interest as well. Sooner or later, the Supreme Court will no doubt want to settle in substantive fashion the many questions that are now being raised about how governments may regulate internet use by minors, consistent with the First Amendment. States won't always get the balance right, and perhaps some of the laws they pass will prove easy to evade, which critics say has been the experience in Australia under its new age law for social media. How will it go in Texas and Ohio? Who knows? Yet many frustrated and alarmed American parents are probably gratified that at least their leaders are finally trying something. Next, we have an article written by James Freeman, "Socialism Still Failing." One of the many benefits of American independence is that His Majesty's government cannot impose its medical system upon us. In the U.S., Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders aims to force all doctors and patients into a government-run plan he calls Medicare for All. Meanwhile, Britain's National Health Service continues to show how badly Sanders-style bureaucracy mistreats patients. The UK's government system has been proudly mismanaging medical resources since the 1940s. Now, one critic is comparing the treatment of expectant mothers to British healthcare of the 1530s. In response to an appalling cover-up of abuses by the government's health service in Nottingham, Claire Cohn writes in the Sunday Times of London, "The other day I left the house in the actual evening to see 1536. The play, which is being made into a BBC series, follows the lives of three women in the days around Annie Boleyn's execution, and of course, one of the themes is how many women and babies died in childbirth back then. The bloody reality is there to see, but my God, were the midwives trying their best to save them? Even when all they had was hot water and torn bedsheets to work with. Did we care more about pregnant women during the reign of Henry VIII? That probably sounds absurd, but it's what I thought when I read about Donna Ockenden's new report. In and the Nottingham maternity scandal. You know the script by now. Women's pleas were ignored. Warning signs and parental concerns dismissed. C-sections refused. Blame culture, denials, cover-ups, grieving families ignored, and left scraping around for the truth. A culture of impunity among midwives who laughed at distress and deliberately assigned difficult births to junior staff to see if they would sink or swim. Heartbreaking, tragic, avoidable deaths and life-limiting disabilities. In 2026, not 1536, my heart goes out to all of them. It's there, but for the grace of stuff, isn't it? Any parent who read about Nottingham or the maternity scandals in Shrewsbury and Telford, Morecambe Bay, East Kent, or any of the 14 trusts currently under investigation will have felt that. Angry, scared, helpless, and that it might have been any of us. A friend messaged to say she felt exactly this way in the aftermath of the Oakendence 2022 report into Shrewsbury, faced with the prospect of giving birth on the NHS herself a few weeks later, rigid with fear. Were my own worries about the treatment I might not get on the labor ward, my local being rated inadequate by the Care Quality Commission, and a rumor flying around that a senior doctor had been disciplined for being drunk on the job, part of the reason why I chose an elective C-section? Undoubtedly, yes. Steve Jones reports for the BBC on government doing what government does. A fitness to practice hearing has begun for two midwives involved in the care of a mother whose baby died 27 minutes after she was born. Fiona Windsor Ram and Dan Ram's daughter, Aliona, died at Leeds General Infirmary in the early hours of January 1, 2020. A 2023 inquest previously found there were a number of gross failures of the most basic nature that directly contributed to Aliona's death. Windsor Ram and her husband were among a group of bereaved and harmed families who successfully campaigned for an independent inquiry into repeated failures at Leeds Teaching Hospitals, NHS Trust's maternity units. In London Sunday Times, David Collum asks, is Leeds the worst maternity scandal in Britain? The Leeds Trust runs two neonatal units split across two sites, Leeds General for the most critically ill babies, and 2 miles away, St. James Hospital, which is a level one unit for infants at lower risks. Staffing issues, poor communication, and overcrowding routinely forced St. James to look after the most critically ill babies in intensive care, despite not having enough qualified specialty nurses. Being too small and lacking emergency procedures and kit. Meanwhile, at other hospitals, consultants said that 8 out of 34 critical cots had to be routinely shut because of staff shortages at Leeds General, Mr. Collins adds. So far, more than 250 families have come forward with allegations that a child or mother was harmed while in the care at Leeds Trust. Of course, the UK government has issued yet another report after yet another series of revelations of horrific failures with yet more recommendations of how the aging system will be reformed with new people in charge. But socialized medicine always has the same results: shortages, political rationing of services, misallotted resources, and patient suffering. Also, at the Times, Eleanor Hayward reports a response to the latest government effort to demonstrate seriousness. The senior midwife, Donna Okenden, has criticized a new national report into NHS maternity failings, saying it will absolutely not make a difference and tells us nothing new. On Tuesday, the Labour peers Baroness Amos, who was commissioned by the government last year, published 8 key recommendations for overhauling NHS care, including appointing a new maternity commissioner. However, the Amos review has been criticized by bereaved families who say its conclusions are surface level and are demanding a statutory public inquiry. Okenden told Times Radio, "I'm really grateful to Baroness Amos and her team for gathering together all this evidence, but I've looked at it overnight and I don't see anything that we didn't already know, that hasn't already spelled out very clearly." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal. Opinion on the Niagara Frontier Radio reading service. Next, we have an article, and this is written by Walter Russell Mead, entitled, "America is More Than a Creed. We're a diverse people, but still a people, not a random aggregation of cosmopolitans." The 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence found Americans, as usual, arguing about who the real Americans are and what it takes to be one. In the run-up to the celebration, your Global View columnist participated in 2 events where American identity was at the center of discussion. One was a conversation with Professor Robert P. George at an event sponsored by the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. The other was a panel at the Aspen Ideas Festival with Monticello's president, Jane Kamensky, and David French of the New York Times, and moderated by NPR's Jen White. At both events, I found myself politely pushing back against assertions that America is best understood as a creedal nation, and that the Declaration is the definitive statement of the American creed. The Declaration is a weighty and world-altering document, but America is more complicated than a set of ideas. Whenever somebody tells me that America is a creedal nation, I think back to my own experience growing up in the Carolinas. Not once in my childhood or adolescence did I ever think of my American identity or anybody else's as creedal, nor did I meet anybody who thought this way. We were Americans not because we believed in a set of ideas. We felt American the way Turks feel Turkish and the French feel French. That didn't mean I bought into what some today call heritage American identity. It was obvious, even to a child, that there was no single American race or ethnicity. The American South in the 1950s might not have been a global melting pot, but black people had been around as long as white people and were as American as anybody else. And somewhere north of Richmond, Virginia, were those mysterious other people called Yankees, very unlike us, God-fearing and patriotic Southerners, but Americans all the same. Ricky Ricardo on I Love Lucy had an accent, but Ricky and Lucy were as American as Ozzie and Harriet Nelson. My American homeland was a complicated place with a lot of different kinds of people in it. When supporters of the creedal nation theory came at me brandishing copies of the Declaration, I respect their sentiments, but maintain my dissent. The Declaration isn't a set of propositions in political science issued by an academic committee. It was issued in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies. When in the course of human events, the Declaration reads, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, the existence of an American people was as self-evident to the founders as the principle the Declaration enumerates. And when it came time to write the Constitution, it was we, the people, who established it. Since colonial times, the American people has been a tribe of tribes. American and Jewish identify following similar paths. Judaism has its creeds and values, but the Jewish people are anything but a consensus-minded group of true believers. Homogeneity has never been the point. Arguing over the meaning of Jewish identity is a characteristic element of Jewish culture. Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, was an atheist who once proposed a mass conversion of Australian Jews to Catholicism, but Herzl was a Jew all the same. American identity works along the same lines. There are creedal Americans, cultural Americans, Americans who embrace the country's diversity and complexity, and Americans who reject it. There are Americans who care as little for the principles of the Declaration as Herzl did for the Law of Moses, but American identity isn't reducible to political opinions. The whole point of the Civil War was that even after attempting to establish a rival nation based on the negotiation of promise of equality in the Declaration, Jefferson Davis remained an American, like it or not. The American people can't be reduced to an ethnic folk bound by ties of blood and soil, nor are we simply a random aggregation of deracinated cosmopolitans connected only by a common adherence to a set of political ideas. We are a people, the mystic chords of memory that Abraham Lincoln invoked in his first inaugural address are real, and they matter. 250 years ago, the founders expressed the aspirations of the American people in imperishable language. Today, American flourishing depends on our sense of common peoplehood, on our resolute defense of the ideas and institutions from which so many generations have derived so many blessings, and on the creative tension between these poles of our national life. E pluribus unum, we are one people with many roots. Long may we squabble over the meaning of America. The freedom to differ helps define who we are. Next, an opinion, life science. Did the Supreme Court steal the midterm elections? Restrictions on party committees violated the Constitution and gave Democrats an advantage. This is written by Alicia Finley. Can you believe it? The mega Supreme Court just rigged the November midterm elections for Republicans. Or so goes the story in the liberal press last week after a 6-3 majority struck down federal limits on the amount of money that party committees can spend in coordination with candidates in the National Senatorial Campaign Committee versus Federal Election Commission. Reporters spilled little ink on the majority's legal analysis, which detailed how spending limits violate the First Amendment's protection of core political speech. Who cares about the Constitution when an election is around the corner? The Supreme Court just gave the GOP a midterm edge, read a New York Times headline. According to Bloomberg News, the ruling by a Republican-appointed supermajority gives the GOP a financial boost this campaign season and may have smoothed the way for Republicans to keep control of Congress in what would otherwise have been a difficult year. If Republicans keep control of Congress in November despite long odds, expect Democrats to blame the court's conservatives rather than acknowledge that nominating and embracing socialist candidates hurt their party. The justices and their liberal critics agree on one point. The removal of the long-standing limit on coordinated party spending will make campaigns more efficient and effective. Both parties will benefit from being able to better coordinate messages and ads. That should reduce political spending, not increase it, as the left claims. Democrats say the GOP will benefit more from the ruling since Republican Party committees are sitting on twice as much cash as Democratic committees. That also means that the status quo ante benefited Democrats. We have to really take seriously the fact that we just lost a major advantage that the Democratic Party has had in the last decade. Danielle Butterfield, president of Democratic Super PAC Priorities USA, told Politico. Republicans funnel more money to party committees while Democrats give more to candidates because federal law and regulations require cable and broadcast TV stations to offer lower ad rates to candidates for public office, but not super PACs or party committees in the 60 days before a general election that Democrats have enjoyed an advertising advantage. After the ruling, GOP candidates are likely to spend more on their war chests on TV ads while letting party committees focus on get out the vote efforts. This could help Republicans, though mainly by neutralizing an advantage the unconstitutional regulation conferred on Democrats. Still, if money could buy elections, Michael Bloomberg, who dumped $1.12 billion into his presidential campaign in 2020, would have been the Democratic nominee that year. Andrew Cuomo would be mayor of New York, and billionaire climate activist Tom Steyer would be California's governor in waiting, rather than an also-ran. In the case of Mr. Steyer, who spent $216 million and finished third, political spending after a certain point, like tax rates on the Laver curve, probably yielded negative returns as voters tired of his ad. New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani showed how social media can be a more effective medium to reach and galvanize young voters. Left-wing insurgents demonstrated again in Colorado's Democratic primaries last week that grassroots organizing and social media prowess can make up for a financial disadvantage. Socialist Milei Kyros ousted Republican Donna DeGette, even though a 30-year incumbent and super PACs supporting her spent three times as much. All that said, the court's ruling could over time strengthen parties and help them squash primary challenges who hurt the party's reputation and general election prospects. More money may flow at the margin to party committees rather than super PACs, though federal limits on contributions to the former remain. The liberal justices claim the NRSC versus the FEC and Citizens United versus FEC in 2010 turbocharge political spending and invite opportunities for quid pro quo corruption. That's hard to figure since Buckley versus Valeo, 1976, candidates have been able to spend unlimited amounts of their own money. Citizens United merely allowed corporations, including nonprofit advocacy groups and unions, to do so as well. What has turbocharged political spending in the massive expansion of government, which raises the stakes of every election? As Justice Neil Gorsuch noted in a concurring opinion last week, citing an alphabet soup of federal agencies, a business out of favor with the party in control of the White House might be able to stave off an FCC investigation, but can it survive a subsequent FTC rule declaring unlawful one of its long-standing trade practices? And what about an in-house education by OSHA, OSHA, or a prosecution for a new crime, the SEC announces? Businesses donate to curry favor with the overlords who can make or break them and their competitors. The left lambastes corporate spending, but their socialist agenda can encourage more of it. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Next, we have Putin may see an opportunity to destroy NATO. Even a small incursion could doom the alliance if it lacks the political will to respond with force. Beyond the familiar human melodrama that will unfold as President Trump meets European leaders at the North Atlantic Treaty Summit in Ankara, Turkey this week, a question looms. Is Vladimir Putin about to attack a NATO member state? On its face, the idea seems preposterous. In his disastrous war on Ukraine, the Russian military has suffered 1.4 million casualties, a third of them killed in action. His economy is faltering as fuel and labor shortages and higher prices eat into his people's living standards. Enemy drones are reaching deeper into his territory, causing damage and fear in similar proportions. He is mired in a struggle against a country with population and a military a fraction of the size of his own. And since the decision to launch that war has worked out so well, we are seriously being asked to believe that he would attack an alliance with an economy and military many times the size of his own? A month ago, I would have scoffed at the idea, but conversations with multiple senior European political, military, and intelligence figures in the past few weeks suggest to me the possibility is real and rising. For some Americans, including perhaps the president, the idea that Russia may take a shot at some feckless Europeans who have been notably unhelpful with America's military preoccupations in recent months might induce a yawn of indifference or even a smirk of schadenfreude. But the risks of any Russian provocation in Europe for America's global security are profound. Ukraine, a non-NATO member, is one thing. If we failed to respond to Russian aggression against a member of the alliance, NATO would become a dead letter, which is why Putin might attack. As one intelligence analyst put it to me last week, his inspiration may be Marshal Ferdinand Foch, the general who commanded French forces at the Battle of Marne in 1914. He famously reported, "My center is yielding, my right is retreating. Situation excellent, I am attacking." A sudden show of unexpected force, just as he appears to be reeling from his ill-advised Ukraine war, could be to Mr. Putin's advantage. Although Mr. Trump's verbal shock treatment has jolted European NATO members into finally doing more in their own defense, they are still nowhere near ready for a defensive war. Government officials say it will be at least 5 years before their militaries are close to being capable of replacing U.S. capabilities in Europe. Mr. Trump has 2.5 years left in office. There is no guarantee his successor will have as skeptical an approach to NATO. If Mr. Putin chooses the right targets, European leaders suspect Mr. Trump's administration wouldn't become a NATO's country's aid, fatally undermining the credibility of the alliance's collective defense commitment, and with it, NATO's existence, a dream outcome for Mr. Putin. His political needs might also be suited by an attack on NATO, a former British defense official said to me last week. After 4 years of failure and rising popular dissent at home, he desperately needs a military victory. What better way to lift morale than to plant the Russian flag in some of NATO's fields? All this suggests we are now in a narrow window of opportunity for Russia to make a move. If Mr. Trump goes ahead with plans to cut European deployments, that window grows wider. Sure enough, intelligence reports point to rising risks of Russian action. Last week, a Polish news report said U.S. officials had warned Warsaw that Russia may attack the country. In an interview last month, a senior military figure from a NATO nation identified multiple risks, including a Russian seizure of islands in the Baltic and an incursion to assist the Russian minority in Estonia. None of these would amount to a full-scale invasion, but each would be enough of a provocation that if NATO failed to respond, its credibility would be in tatters. Is Europe really worth defending with U.S. blood and treasure? Is NATO still an essential strategic interest? I've long sympathized with the argument that a large U.S. commitment to the European theater is an anachronism in our security posture, a throwback to the 20th century geopolitics. China is obviously the biggest threat to the U.S. security and leadership. Managing that relationship requires a shift of strategic resources and attention toward the Pacific. The Europeans can and should take care of their own freedom and security. But whether we want it or not, we are in a cold to simmering war with an axis of resistance that runs from Beijing through Tehran to Moscow. The U.S. is still dealing with the fallout of an inclusive war with Iran that has left us military depleted. And as we scramble to manage potential opportunistic moves by China's Jinping in the Asia Pacific, Mr. Putin could deal a timely and fatal blow to an already weakened transatlantic alliance. That would be another hammer to the head of Western security and a dramatic enforcement of the power of Russia's alliance with China and our other adversaries. Perhaps all the talk of an imminent Russian attack is merely disinformation from European officials trying to keep President Trump from further weakening NATO. But if you were the American president, would you want to take the risk? Next, we have a commentary on a conservative court, but no monolith. Republican-appointed justices aren't consistently originists and don't vote in lockstep, unlike liberals. Written by Elizabeth Price Fowley and Mark Pinkert. The Supreme Court just ended term should but won't silence critics who claim its conservative majority is pro-Trump or ideologically monolithic. The six Republican-appointed justices haven't operated as a predictable block. Most of them aren't consistently originalists and often use other methods of interpretation. Pragmaticism, institutionalism, incrementalism, textualism instead. By contrast, the three Democratic appointed justices almost always vote together in contentious cases. As a result, the ostensibly of the conservative court has fluid majority coalitions that don't produce consistent conservative wins. Two related decisions handed down on June 29th, both written by Chief Justice John Roberts, illustrates that point. In Trump versus Slaughter, the court held that the Constitution gives the president power to fire subordinate executive officers, which Congress can't restrict by statute. But in Trump versus Cook, It carved out an exception for Federal Reserve governors, as Justice Amy Barrett noted in her Cook dissent. These rulings stand in serious tension. That tension flows from differing interpretive methodologies. Slaughter used originalism. Cook gestures at originalism, but ultimately turns on pragmaticism, that is, attention to the perceived real-world effects of the ruling. All six Republican-appointed justices joined in Slaughter to override a key New Deal-era precedent, Humphrey's Executor versus U.S., 1935. All three Democrat-appointed justices dissented. Humphrey's Executor held that Congress should establish independent agencies whose officers were substantially insulated from presidential removal. It laid the foundation of modern deep state by enabling the creation of a bureaucratic resistance to presidential control, effectively creating an unaccountable fourth branch of government. The Slaughter opinion is a model of originalist mythology. It examined Article II's text, which vests the executive power in a single president and gives him the power to appoint, with Senate consent, executive officers. It then examined these provisions' original public meaning, gleaned from the Federalist Papers, constitutional convention records, and state ratifying convention debates. Based on these sources, Slaughter concluded that executive officers were created to serve as envoys of the president, not his equals. To assist the president in carrying out his executive power, not to exercise power independent of him. Because of this, executive officers must remain accountable to the president and the president to the people, and neither Congress nor the courts may saddle him with those with whom he cannot work. Emphasis the courts. Cook took a sharply different approach. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh joined their three liberal colleagues in an opinion that abandoned originalism in favor of pragmaticism. Rather than relying on constitutional text or founding era materials, the majority divined an unwritten principle from the existence of the first and second national banks, that monetary policy should not be subject to political interference. That principle, the majority reasoned, justified an exception to the constitutional rule just announced in Slaughter. Four justices dissented. Justice Thomas said the first and second banks were an ahistorical analogy, because they were far weaker than the Federal Reserve and exercised no executive power. Justice Barrett agreed, highlighting the inconsistency between the two cases. How can history support both a categorical rule and a carve-out? The Cook majority didn't even discuss the deep historical divisions among the founders over the constitutionality of a national bank. In 1791, James Madison, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, and Attorney General Edmund Randolph all argued that a national bank was unconstitutional. Only Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton argued otherwise. President George Washington signed the bill creating the first bank of the U.S., but Congress gave it a 20-year charter. when that charter expired in 1811, Congress declined to renew it. The second bank was chartered in 1816, and the Supreme Court held that it was constitutional in McCulloch versus Maryland in 1819. But the debate raged for many years thereafter. In 1932, President Andrew Jackson vetoed a reauthorization of the Second Bank's charter, declaring it an unconstitutional monopoly favoring a few over the many. Congress failed to override the veto, and the Second Bank's charter expired in 1836. For 77 years, the U.S. had no central bank until the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. The conservative justices have other jurisprudential differences: Learning Resources versus Trump posed a question of statutory interpretation. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Neil Gorsuch and Barrett joined the three liberal justices to conclude that the International Emergency Economic Powers Act didn't authorize President Trump's tariffs. In Trump versus Barbara, the Chief Justice and Justice Barrett joined the liberal bloc in holding that the 14th Amendment confers citizenship to U.S.-born children whose parents are in the country unlawfully or temporarily. The other four conservatives disagreed with the majority of the Citizenship Clause original meaning. In Chartres versus U.S., Federal Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh joined the three liberal judges to rule that the police violate the Fourth Amendment by using a broad geofence warrant to pull Google location data for all phones in the specific area. Chartres amplified a non-originalistic Warren court decision, Katz versus the U.S. in 1967, in which the liberal judge Hugo Black accused the majority of rewriting the Fourth Amendment to bring it into harmony with the times. There's no obvious ideological through line in these important decisions. The Republican-appointed justices methodically has flexibility. It means that the three liberal justices only need two colleagues, usually including Chief Justice Roberts, to win major cases. For Republicans and conservatives, the result is frequent frustration, reminiscent of Justices Sandra Day O'Connell and Anthony Kennedy. Liberals find the court frustrating too, not because of their justices, but because there aren't enough of them, hence the call for the court to leave the court packing. If it ever happens, it will transform the court into what the left falsely claims it is now, another partisan branch producing predictable results and destroying the judiciary's independence forever. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the July 4th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal review every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader has been Susan, and thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service is the New York Times. At 9 o'clock is Harper's Magazine. And at 10 o'clock is episode number 14 of Never Flinch by Stephen King. Stay with us for these readings and more. If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2 for every $100 in Dash's register tapes. Radio reading has raised thousands of dollars so far. Anyone can drop off their Dash's tapes to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. or Dash's tapes can be mailed to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, New York, 14227. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability.